This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday was the funeral of Deng Xiaoping, one of the architects of modern China and of China's policy toward Hong Kong. On July 1st, Hong Kong will again become part of China after 150 years as a British colony. A drama about business and human rights is unfolding in Hong Kong. Capitalism is booming, but China has already moved to dilute civil liberties. Earlier this week, America's new Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, met with Chinese leaders and told them that Washington wants a smooth transition which respects Hong Kong's autonomy, freedoms, and capitalism. My guest, Dan Sesser, has an article about Hong Kong in the current New Republic. He formerly wrote about Southeast Asia for The New Yorker and is now Senior Fellow of the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley. He says that what's happening in Hong Kong symbolizes what's happening in a lot of Asia and the rest of the world.
The business community, the big multinational companies around the world, seem to be dominating now foreign policy. And the United States, when Bill Clinton ran for president in 1990, he was harshly critical of China on human rights. And now, in 1997, the Clinton administration is taking the position that, well, we'll mention human rights, but we're not going to carry any sort of stick. We're not going to threaten any sort of consequences. And Hong Kong is a place that has gotten a tremendous amount of newly won freedom from the British over the last 10 years. It's a territory that finally has a large degree of democracy and a large degree of civil liberties, and these are being swept away even before China officially takes over Hong Kong on July 1st.
It seems like there's two separate stories going on in Hong Kong, and one is what's at stake for business, and the other is what's at stake for democracy and human rights. Maybe we could break these down and look at how these stories are both independent and entwined.
Well, I think that China has very clearly gotten the message that you make every concession to the business community, and making concessions to the business community is a very profitable thing for China to do, and then you're free to do whatever you want with human rights, and you'll take a little verbal abuse, but nothing much is going to happen to you. So China has said to the Western business community operating in Hong Kong, go ahead and do what you've always done in the past, and we're going to extend every consideration toward you. And at the same time, China has been saying to those who value democracy and civil liberties in Hong Kong that we're going to systematically strip away everything that you've gained. And the feeling is that they're going to get away. Their feeling is that they're going to get away with it, and I think that's really true.
What's in it for China to make sure that the business community can operate in a profitable way in Hong Kong?
Well, first of all, a lot of Hong Kong business now is controlled by China. Chinese companies, many of them owned by the Chinese government and the Chinese army, have made huge investments in Hong Kong. And a lot of the Western companies operating in Hong Kong have realized that to continue in business, they're going to have to sell big stakes in their companies to China. So, for instance, Swire, the big British trading company, sold last year a majority interest in its airline, Cathay Pacific, to a Chinese company operating in Hong Kong. So the leaders in China, the leading businessmen, the politicians, leading army officers are going to get very, very rich from dealing with Hong Kong. I think that they look upon the business community in Hong Kong as a great, great asset.
It seems like while the residents of Hong Kong are bracing themselves to lose civil liberties, that the stock market is booming. Why is the stock market booming?
The stock market is booming, I think, because business feels very comfortable with an authoritarian government. What was happening in Hong Kong before, Hong Kong had legislative elections in 1995, and 20 of the 60 legislative seats were up for general vote by universal suffrage. And this was the first time something like this has happened in Hong Kong. And of those 20 seats, 12 of them were captured by the Democratic Party, a very socially progressive party. Now, the pro-Beijing party, even though Hong Kong voters knew that Beijing was going to take over their country in a year and a half, the pro-Beijing party got just 2 seats and just 16% of the vote. So Hong Kong voters were showing where their sympathies lay. And I think for the business community saw this as a real danger because Hong Kong has very low taxes. It provides no sort of welfare benefits or anything like that. Business keeps all the profit it makes. And I think that the stock market was, investors were more frightened by the idea of the Democrats coming to power in Hong Kong and maybe clamping down on business and maybe taxing business to support some poor people in Hong Kong than they were with the authoritarian rule in China. And there has been absolute euphoria in Hong Kong. It's just unbelievable to go to Hong Kong today and see what's going on. A friend of mine bought a 970-square-foot apartment. This is when I was there in December. He bought this apartment in a middling neighborhood, no view, noisy streetcar outside. For his tiny little apartment, he paid $900,000 U.S. And I just saw him last week, and he hasn't even moved in yet. The construction hasn't finished. And he said the apartments in his building are now selling for $1.1 million. So it's increased $200,000 in just 2 months. It's an absolute speculative mania.
Who's doing the speculation? Is it a lot of foreigners who expect to make big bucks there now?
A lot of Chinese money is coming in, number one. And number two is that a lot of Hong Kong residents who left, who got visas mainly to Canada in the early 1990s after Tiananmen Square, who were very worried about the future of Hong Kong, are now trying to get back and are trying to buy their apartments back and discovering that they have to pay 3 times as much as they sold them for.
You compare what's happening in Hong Kong to what's already happened in Singapore. An authoritarian rule that gives business a free hand, but not individuals.
Singapore is showing the world how to do it. Everyone laughed at Singapore and thought that Singapore was really an anomaly in the world. And now Singapore is giving an important lesson to countries like China and like Vietnam, which is you give the business community absolute freedom, and then you're free to clamp down on the rights of individuals to whatever extent you want, and you can remain very friendly with the West. In Singapore, for instance, an individual who wants to log on to the internet has to go through a government computer. And if that individual asks for a website, such as Playboy's, that the government doesn't like, the computer will reject the request. But business doesn't have to go through a government computer. They can get to any website they want. There's a two-track system. Businesses can own satellite dishes. Individuals can't own satellite dishes. They have to get their television from cable so that the government, if it doesn't like what's on CNN, for instance, can just pull the plug. Now it seems that China is learning the lesson, and the new chief executive designate of Hong Kong, Tung Chi Hwa, who was appointed by Beijing, has openly expressed his admiration for Singapore and Lee Kuan Yew. And it looks as if Hong Kong is about to become a second Singapore.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stan Sesser, and he has an article in the New Republic called The Betrayal of Hong Kong. He's a former staff writer for The New Yorker, covering Southeast Asia, and he's senior fellow at the Human Rights Center, the University of California at Berkeley. Stan, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about Hong Kong. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Stan Sesser, and he's written about Hong Kong in the latest edition of The New Republic. Let's look more closely about what's happening with human rights in Hong Kong now. China has said that it would be willing to allow one country, two systems. In other words, one system for Hong Kong and another system for mainland China. How do you interpret that?
Well, this came in 1984 as a gesture by Deng Xiaoping when Britain and China first reached agreement on Hong Kong being turned over to China in July 1997. And it was magnanimous gesture on China's part. And I think it came largely because Hong Kong in 1984 was mainly a slave plantation of Britain. China was very comfortable with the Hong Kong that it saw in 1984. There was no democracy whatsoever. There was a series of very restrictive colonial laws that the British had in place in all their Asian colonies that gave the British the power, if it wanted, to censor the press and to trample on civil liberties at will. And then after Tiananmen Square, things changed very dramatically. There was a demonstration in Hong Kong that was absolutely unprecedented in Hong Kong history. 1 million people poured out into the streets. And the British decided that they had to salvage their reputation. The colonial laws were scrapped. Democracy was introduced in the legislative elections. And people responded very positively. This meant a lot. This hit a real chord in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong became a very different place. So China found itself in the mid-1990s taking over a very, very different territory than what it saw in 1984. So it's a very different Hong Kong today, and China has simply decided to systematically strip away these liberties.
What has Beijing done so far to strip away liberties? I mean, for example, it's going to disband the Hong Kong democratically elected legislature.
Right. And the legislature on July 1st will be replaced by a Beijing-appointed legislature, the provisional legislature, which is already passing laws effective July 1st that, for instance, will require demonstrators to get police permission to demonstrate. So a fine chance the annual June 4th Tiananmen Square demonstration will have if you have to get police permission to demonstrate starting when China takes over. Requiring everyone who forms a group to register with the government and get government permission to have that group formed. There'll be a subversion law which will give the Hong Kong China-run government a license to throw any dissident into prison and say, we're just following the system of laws. This man violated the law.
China is also, I think, preparing to reinstitute colonial laws that the British had actually passed years ago in an attempt to control the pro-communist China left in Hong Kong.
That's another. It's a Singaporean technique again. If you remember when Michael Fay was caned in Singapore, and the Singapore government said, well, you know, you say that caning is barbaric. Who introduced caning laws into Singapore but the British? And so the Chinese can do exactly the same thing. All these British colonial laws were designed to keep communist sympathizers suppressed in Hong Kong during the years of the Cultural Revolution and whatever. And now these same laws will be turned on their face and used against supporters of democracy.
You know, I'm wondering if any of the businessmen in Hong Kong who you interviewed have a kind of dual feeling, like they're pleased that business will still be given a free hand, but they're concerned about crackdowns against human rights.
There's one supporter in the Hong Kong business community of human rights, and this is a man, an American, who lived in Hong Kong for 23 years. He now lives half the year in San Francisco, named John Kam, who's a business consultant in Hong Kong. He still works in Hong Kong. And he has... He was the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in 1990 and worked for human rights, and he's made 31 trips to Beijing to negotiate on behalf of dissidents and has had considerable success. And I asked him, I said, I can't find anyone who I'm interviewing. I want to interview one person in the business community who can speak in support of democracy and human rights. Who can I see? And he said, well, I can tell you about lawyers and doctors and small businessmen. But when you get to companies, say, over $5 million a year in revenue, there's no one. There's absolutely no one. The business community en masse has looked toward its own special interests and the huge profits to be made in the future in Chinese markets, and has completely abandoned even lip service to democracy and human rights. It's a scandal.
How important to Hong Kong is access to Chinese markets? Maybe you could give us a scope of the market of China, why that's so important to businesses now.
Well, you look at China in any respect. One-third of the world's cigarettes are smoked in China, and virtually none of them are Western cigarettes. And none of the smokers are women. So the Western tobacco companies look at the China market and they say, my God, all we have to do is tell women you can be slim and fashionable by smoking cigarettes, and we can addict all the women in China and have them smoke Western cigarettes instead of the Chinese brands. You look at the cars. No one owns a private car except for high officials and rich businessmen. And there are 1.2 billion people in China and a growing middle class. So I mean, it represents the last untapped market.
How do you think the death of Deng Xiaoping changes the picture in China?
Well, in terms of Hong Kong, Deng Xiaoping, of course, was the author of the One Country, Two Systems policy. And I think that his death gives the current rulers in China more freedom to do what they will with Hong Kong, although One Country, Two Systems seemed to be going down the tubes even before his death. And in China itself, there's not going to be any impact for a while, and it's going to take a long time to sort out. And the bottom line seems to be to what extent Jiang Zemin, the president of China, can pacify the army and keep the army on his side. It's the army that's the real threat to the current government of China, not democracy advocates, not dissidents. It's the army that represents the real threat.
Are you hoping to be in Hong Kong on July 1st when the transfer happens?
Well, I don't think that anything very dramatic is going to happen on July 1st. Everyone is going to... everyone's been asking the question, you know, will there be a massive roundup of dissidents? But I don't think that China can be that blind to the public relations value of at least waiting a month till there are going to be 6,000 foreign journalists in Hong Kong then. So there are just going to be a lot of ceremonies and a lot of crowds. I'll be there, but I expect it to be a pretty boring time.
When China takes control of Hong Kong, do you think that will change Chinese relationships with America or change the balance of power?
I think it's an indication that the fact that China will take over and that democracy and civil liberties will be virtually abolished or substantially cut back from day one, I think that's a very strong indication that China is increasingly winning every battle it undertakes, that the balance of power, if you consider China as it really should probably be considered today, as the number two superpower in the world next to the United States. China's economy, there are predictions that it will overtake the American economy by the year 2020. And if you consider China as the number two superpower, I think that the balance has been tilting from the United States to China, that China has won everything that it's undertaken.
What do you think the United States alternatives are in trying to influence China to maintain human rights in Hong Kong?
The only action that the United States has ever taken, I mean, in recent years, that has had a profound influence on China was the sending of the warships to the Taiwan Straits last March, when China was launching missiles in the direction of Taiwan. I think this had a profound influence on China. No harassments of Taiwan have taken place since then. And if we're led to the conclusion that the only thing that China understands is belligerent action, that's frightening. I mean, we can't threaten war at every point that China does something that we don't like. At some point, China will call our bluff. And this is the profound problem for American policymakers, to find a way to influence China and at the same time not provoke a Cold War or, for that matter, a hot war. And the Clinton administration is now trying the tactic of being nice to China and saying we're going to allow you to do what you want, and we're just going to slap your hand, but we're not going to really do anything. And we hope that you'll look upon us kindly and will toss us a few bones as concessions. Now, that's never – weakness has never resulted – a demonstration of weakness rather than strength has never resulted in Chinese concessions in the past. Chinese look upon weakness traditionally as something to be exploited, not to be made concessions to. So who knows?
Well, Stan Sesser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Stan Sesser's article on Hong Kong is in the current edition of The New Republic. He's currently a senior fellow at the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.